This is episode 137 of the A News Podcast, which covers anarchist activity, ideas, and conversations from the previous week on anarchist news. It's designed to be useful to anarchists and the anarcho-curious. Give us feedback and constructive criticism by email at podcast@anarchistnews.org. For more information and usually some good commentary, see you at your favorite non-sectarian anarchist site, anarchistnews.org.
What's new this week? Kiev, Ukraine, anarchists burn a police car. From a2day.net. In this currently news-heavy region, a note from a different quarter. Mostly this is a straightforward communique, although there's a bit of humor toward the end. Quote, in 2015, Japan handed over about 1,500 Toyota Prius to the Ministry of Internal Affairs of Ukraine for patrol police. By now, about 1,300 patrol Priuses have been broken or are out of order. There is little left. Let's help the cops finish the job, unquote. Mostly it talks about corporations and cops, which is all very well. The location makes it more interesting than the action itself. Although there's obviously nothing wrong with targeting cops, I'm always torn about actions that go for low-hanging fruit. Perhaps going after cops in Ukraine is more controversial than it is here? Or maybe I have forgotten how controversial it is here, too. Come on, normies, catch up!
An anarchist critique and analysis of recent climate mobilizations in Vancouver, BC, from It's Going Down. Oh joy, another quote-unquote anarchist critique from IGD. What's that you say? Extinction Rebellion are liberals promoting nonviolent direct actions and appeals to the state's morality? It's frustrating to operate as anarchists within a context of such limited confrontation? Maybe you need a lot more people to make a dent? If the content had been more interesting, I might have not been so irritated by the terrible punctuation and grammar of this piece. Its one bright spot was the use of black dot to describe a mass group too small to make a difference, which has multiple unfortunate implications. Anyway, IGD continues to put the left in anarchists. Did you see what I did there? Did you? Not a ton of comments for this thread, but all pretty much on point.
Precursors of Syndicalism 4, from Anarchist Writers, by Anarcho. Number 4 in this series is for, quote, anarchist communist criticisms of revolutionary syndicalism, unquote. I haven't made enough room in my head to remember if previous series sections have explained the difference between syndicalism and revolutionary syndicalism, but one wonders why Anarcho made the distinction here. At any rate, the next paragraph indicates why it's hard for me to pay too much attention to this. Quote, there were three main critiques made. First, that unions are not inherently revolutionary, and so anarchists had to organize as anarchists to influence them. Second, that the general strike was not sufficient to achieve a revolutionary transformation. Third, that syndicalism focused exclusively on just one aspect of life, albeit an essential one, namely production, unquote. Obviously, I am not an anarchist communist, so undoubtedly my criticism is irrelevant to Anarcho at all. But surely the more significant critiques involve unions not only being not necessarily revolutionary, but decidedly non-revolutionary. Anarcho continues to be one of the few syndicalists who is trying to explain things to the larger milieu, and I can hardly complain that he's not speaking to me, since he is so very clear about it. This piece attempts to reclaim some folks, most notably Malatesta, for the syndicalists. Malatesta said, and Kropotkin agreed, that, quote, syndicalism could not and should not replace the anarchist movement. One had to be open to all workers and seek improvements within capitalism. The other was required to work systematically within it to ensure it did not adapt to that reality. History shows the validity of this critique. There is nothing inherent within unions that ensure that they become or remain revolutionary or even radical. The forces of bureaucracy and adjustment, the need to keep agreements with bosses, have turned almost all unions reformist and moderate. The exceptions are those with militants who work at the base to keep it radical, unquote. How deep do the issues with our current world go? How much do we as anarchists have to challenge to make the kinds of changes we want? Anarcho continues to be worth reading to understand this very different kind of anarchism, though I admit I didn't get all the way through this piece. That probably says more about my attention span than it does about its worth.
Chilean anarchist revolutionary Tamara Sol released from prison, from AMW English. An announcement of some of the information about her case and the context. Oddly, for such a short piece, it connects insurrectionary Chileans to both the Greeks and Mauricio Morales. Quote, Tamara Sol, a Chilean anarchist revolutionary, was sentenced in 2014 to 7 years and 61 days imprisonment shooting a Banco Estado security guard in revenge for the death of anarchist comrade Sebastian Overluge. Unquote. Best of luck to Tamara.
Catalunya, a week of escalation from CrimeThink. Quote, protesters have reportedly used caltrops, Molotov cocktails, and paint balloons to disable police riot vans while keeping individual officers at a distance with lasers and slingshots and driving away helicopters with fireworks. In the following report, we review the events of the past week and explore what is at stake in the struggle. Unquote. This piece, which frames itself in the anarchist space between desiring people resisting in the streets and knowing that at best this is only a step toward actual anarchist goals, compares what is going on now with what happened in 2017 in the same region over the same argument, that is, sovereignty for Catalonia. There is full sensitivity here to the quandary that anarchists are in such situations. It includes the machinations of the political parties that hope to gain power, the non-governmental agencies that might also want that, unaffiliated individuals, and anarchists, among other semi-identifiable forces, including pacifists, immigrants, Catalan speakers, etc. This piece is well worth reading and includes a line that I would wear on a button, never underestimate states, also never underestimate statist stupidity. The location, quality of writing, and anarchist analysis, paying attention, IGD, mark this anonymous author as someone who is probably known to us for those who like to play the game of name that anon.
Evade and struggle. Riots break out against austerity in Chile. From CrimeThink. In some places and for some people, there is still a public space worth speaking of. Spaces where people come together to see themselves as members of a group that is relevant to them. Places where the fact that we are many and they are few still feels meaningful. Mass transportation is one such place for those benighted places and populations who remain un-Uberfied. And Chileans are remembering and learning that fare is a weak point. Quote, Friday's conflagration took place following a week of action against fare increases under the slogan Evade, or Evade y Lucha, Dodge the Fare and Struggle, which now appears on nearly every wall downtown in spray paint. It all started as a playful response to the government increasing the cost of living by hiking transport costs. Almost entirely student-led, the mobilization included mass evasions in metro stations in which students run through the turnstiles together, hold open the gates to encourage everyone else to join them in riding for free. Police have reacted with tear gas and batons. On Friday, protesters responded by targeting the stations themselves, breaking apart the gates and turnstiles, and even using them as weapons to defend themselves from police attacks. Many metro lines shut down. Mid-afternoon, we received word that the metro will be shut down for the whole weekend, unquote. Let's be clear, this is mostly riot porn, but it definitely scratches that fetish itch.
The ceasefire is a deadly fraud, from CrimeThink. States lie. Ceasefires only work between good faith actors, which usually does not include statists. The Kurds were always going to be screwed. There was never any way that any kind of sovereignty, much less an anarchist-flavored one, would be allowed by the neighbors of such a project, not to mention bigger nations. And the remarkable thing is always that people fight back anyway. The Kurds continue to be remarkable. Quote, to the dictionary of Orwellian doublespeak in Syria, alongside peace spring and ceasefire, we can add safe zone as a word for killing fields. It's hard to imagine anything more brazen than killing thousands of people, displacing hundreds of thousands, and enabling jihadis to resume their activity throughout the region, and justifying all this on the grounds that it is necessary to defend Turkey from terrorism, unquote.
The Anarchist Big Issue, from Freedom News UK. Apparently in a bid for street cred, there's now a UK anarchist publication called Dope, given to street vendors to sell to support themselves and prisoners. Quote, it's just one of the texts put out by radical publishers Dog Section Press, as well as a pamphlet series on great anarchists, an upcoming book on fascism by the crew behind 12 Rules for What, Subvertising Text, Advertising Shits in Your Head, and books directly supporting international autonomous struggles, unquote. There is not much going on in this post, although I didn't visit the many links, so maybe that's where the action was. As for the comment thread, even two incel-style comments on strippers is too many, although the responses were appropriate enough. Be the stripper you want to see in the world, indeed.
Exarchia, how Airbnb angered Greek anarchists. From BBC, mainstreamiest media. A bit of setting the context, going back at least to the Grigoropoulos in 2008, to today's state threats against Exarchia, then to the heartbreak of apartment owners just trying to make a buck in a hard situation. Quote, another factor is Greece's golden visa scheme, in which a five-year EU residency permit is granted in exchange for an investment worth at least 250,000 euros. Many of the radical far-left movements with a strong footing in the area have now begun calling for tourists to leave. They're using social media to spread their message. The real problem is the touristification, which Airbnb is part of, says Athena Arampatsi, a member of an Exarchia residence group. We all recognize that Airbnb was a survival solution to the crisis for many people in the beginning. But now, she says, the solution has turned into a threat, resulting in people being pushed out of the neighborhood. We have seen whole buildings being purchased by investors, she adds, unquote. Like a good mainstream news source, the BBC even found an anarchist who argues for Airbnb and says no one can tell him what to do. And the piece more or less ends with a quotation from Airbnb talking about how much money they've brought to the Greek economy and how the new government threatens to remake Exarchia. Remember, kids, you got it from Transmetropolitan first, even if it was buried in a lot of other stuff.
Anarchist Zemitser Palyinka attempts suicide in courtroom from Belset.eu, which seems to be a new site of Eastern European skepticism, if not exactly leftism. Whatever Eastern European leftism might even look like, for that matter. Anyway, Polyinka had been in prison before, and his attempt to slash his wrists certainly drew attention to the case, after causing an uproar in the courtroom. There are many pictures. On Friday, October 25th, there is a follow-up story about him on Belsat that 3 of 4 charges were dropped, that he was found guilty and then put on house arrest. One expects that this is a victory of some sort, perhaps the best one can get in the circumstances.
Week of public transport, sabotage, and fare evasion sparks social insurrection from anarchists worldwide. This is a repetitive reposting of announcements from Facebook, apparently, to other Chileans, but it's in English, so I'm confused. Are they suggesting a worldwide fare strike? No one tell KK. He'll expire from excitement. Quote, in the streets, you can see the smile on the faces of all those who protest, dancing to the rhythm of the barricades and enjoying the chaos, the solidarity between them and the self-organization without bosses or leaders. Many have waited for this moment all their lives, and they are not wasting it. The protests have spread to other cities, the accumulated rage exploding with uncontrollable violence. Unquote. Gotta love the incendiary rhetoric, anyway. This post came before martial law was instituted. More on that later.
Chile resisting under martial law, from CrimeThink. And here we are. Quote, since the revolt in Ecuador spread to Chile, the conflict has escalated rapidly. The government has called in the military and declared martial law, but people refuse to leave the streets, continuing to create an ungovernable situation. Despite the swift cancellation of the metro fare increase that first triggered the protests, their anger runs much deeper. Many throughout the country are enraged by the dramatic disparities in wealth and power that capitalism has created, and infuriated by the president's decision to attempt to crush protests by means of the military, a strategy that recalls the military dictatorship of 1973 to 1990. Strikes and protests are taking place around the country today, in Punta Arenas, Concepcion, Valparaiso, Valdivia, and Temuco, as well as Santiago. Unquote. The beginning of this is a recitation of the events, then brief analysis, then an interview that sets historical and cultural context, and then goes into current events again. Quote, it's difficult to say with certainty how many protesters have been injured because the news is flooded with police press releases about how many police were injured, without even mentioning the demonstrators they have hurt, hiding the true level of their repression. However, the number of injured demonstrators is definitely in the hundreds, including people hit by clubs, tear gas canisters shot at people's bodies and heads, people hit at close range by rubber bullets, people run over by police vehicles, and so on. This is still going on as I write, and neither the police nor the armed forces seem to have taken control. They moved the curfew up tonight, Sunday, October 20th, to 7 p.m., and fake news is circulating about shortages of food and basic goods in order to frighten the population. Unquote.
Distributaries from the Libertarian Labyrinth. The author continues his series of pieces on the flows of anarchy, coming to fluid questions of orthodoxy with a grounding in history. Quote, in general, I think, we'll find this period in the radical history of the United States full of interesting characters and episodes, many of which related to more familiar sorts of anarchist history, but also a bit hard to make sense of as a whole, if only because familiar attitudes towards government, authority, and hierarchy will so often be found in contexts that do not seem to be ours. One hopes there will have been opportunities in the first volume to redraw the boundaries of proper contexts for anarchist thought in earlier times and other settings. But ultimately, there is no escaping the fact that the pursuit of the anarchist idea has often not been neatly separate from pursuits that seem decidedly cranky and weird. But perhaps there are lessons to learn about the practical side of anarchy from an examination of cranks who were every bit as serious and organized as they were eccentric and diverse. In any event, we probably can't set the question aside if we want to take a closer look at the various reform leagues that were a vehicle for comparatively big tent organizing in support of a variety of radical agendas, unquote. Anyone want to start a project called Serious, Organized, Eccentric, and Diverse? I don't care what it does, I will join it.
Chile, from protest to insurgency, from a las barricadas via autonomies. Quote, since Saturday, Chile has lived under a state of emergency in five regions of the country. The military is patrolling the streets, and there are reports of police and military abuse of all kinds. After a week of protests due to the fare rise for public transportation, President Piñera wanted to pull off a coup d'etat and end the protests on the fast track. Not only has he not succeeded, but he has opened a crisis in the country of great proportions. Tomorrow, brackets today, Monday, an attempt will be made to carry out a general strike initiated by the port unions, unquote. This is a compilation of pieces from various groups and sources, including CrimeThink, Sindicato de Oficios Varios, and the Santiago Anarchist Federation. And ANU seems to have a dedicated CrimeThink promoter now, so that's a bit more balanced than usual. Good for them.
Pittsburgh anarcho-punk compilation album, Filler Distro. From fillerpgh.wordpress.com, an announcement for a fundraiser album for the Big Idea bookstore. Quote, over the last 18 years, the Big Idea has become a second home for many Pittsburgh anarchists. The space's rent got jacked up recently, and it's likely to get raised again in the coming months. With that in mind, some filler kids figured it was time we pay the Big Idea back for all the coffee, books, zines, pins, patches, and vegan goodies that we've nabbed over the years. We found some cheap recording equipment and decided to hit up our friends to see if anyone wanted to record a track or two for a benefit compilation album. Now that the album's done, we're offering free recording to anarchist bands / musicians living near the Three Rivers, so hit us up for free recording. Unquote. Adorable! There's also a zine with lyrics coming out soon. Continuing adorableness.
Audio and video, The Great Armored Train, an hour from We Will Remember Freedom, read by Ben Church. A short, funny story about a giant armored train, Leon Trotsky, and possible shape-shifting from anarchist-adjacent horror, science fiction, and fantasy writer Nick Mamatas. Although this piece would fall under a general category of political, as it uses political / historical figures to mock Soviet communism, I really do enjoy that most of the pieces on We Will Remember Freedom avoid having a super obvious positive or negative political position that would take away from the storytelling.
Anarchist medics in Rojava speak, plus solidarity with SC prisoners. An hour and 20 minutes from The Final Straw. The episode starts off with an impassioned piece by Sean Swain concerning Rojava, moving on to an interview with Blue Ridge anarchist Black Cross about, quote, the ongoing and increasingly dire situation in South Carolina prisons, unquote, and then on to an interview with two combat medics in Rojava. The interview isn't particularly in-depth, so it's hard to get a good sense of who these people are and where they're coming from, but hearing them stumble over their words as they try not to call ISIS, quote, detention centers, unquote, prisons, was certainly something.
The Ex-Worker 67, an hour and 10 minutes from CrimeThink. This is a reading of CrimeThink's 2015 piece, Understanding the Kurdish Resistance, a Historical Overview and Eyewitness Report, which, surprisingly, talks about the history of Kurdish resistance, and a later interview with one of the essay's authors. I did not listen to all of this episode, but if you want you some Rojava, then you can listen and get some Rojava. Rojava, Rojava, Rojava.
Anarchy Bang, Anarchism and the Occult, 2 hours. Quote, this week we are going to discuss the relationship between anarchism and the occult. What is the occult, especially in the context of anarchism? We'll discuss the recent book on anarchism and the occult. If things go well, we'll discuss spiritual practice prior to the Enlightenment and what will happen when the center no longer holds and we live beyond measure. We hope this week there will be special guests and it'll be the spookiest episode yet, unquote.
This is America number 92, an hour and 55 minutes from IGD. Just in case you're still hungry for Rojava, this is an interview with an Assyrian anarchist in Rojava covering, quote, the withdrawal of U.S. troops, the ongoing Turkish invasion, the impact the bombings have had to the civilian population, the extent of the social and political revolution inside of the autonomous areas, and how anarchists are attempting to aid in the struggle, unquote. Then, kind of out of nowhere, two hosts have a conversation on left unity, with one of them giving a, even if it wasn't on a fucking IGD podcast, pretty succinct and thoughtful explanation of a post-left position. On IGD. On IGD! This brief, beautiful flash of thought is then mostly extinguished as the second host continues to talk about how leftism is just holding back, quote, movements and struggles, unquote, and the two just keep moving on, never acknowledging that they're, as someone else pointed out to me, disagreeing with each other and themselves.
Burning Cascade Head from Braiding Sweetgrass by Robin Kimmerer. Far out beyond the surf, they felt it. Beyond the reach of any canoe, half a sea away, something stirred inside them, an ancient clock of bone and blood that said, it's time. Silver-scaled body, its own sort of compass needle spinning in the sea, the floating arrow turned toward home. From all directions they came, the sea a funnel of fish, narrowing their path as they gathered closer and closer until their silver bodies lit up the water, red mates sent to sea, prodigal salmon coming home. The coastline here is scalloped with countless coves, clothed in fog banks and cut with rainforest rivers, an easy place to lose your way, where landmarks can vanish in the fog. The spruce are heavy on the shore, their black cloaks hiding signs of home. The elders speak of lost canoes that strayed in the wind and landed on a sand spit not their own. When the boats are too long gone, their families go down to the beach to light a blaze among the driftwood, a beacon to sing them home to safety. When the canoes finally approach, laden with food from the sea, the hunters are honored in dances and songs, their dangerous journey repaid by faces alight with gratitude. And so it is, too, that the people make ready for the arrival of their brothers who bring food in the canoe of their bodies. The people watch and wait. The women sew one more row of dentalia shells upon their finest garments for the dance. They pile alderwood for the welcome feast and sharpen huckleberry skewers. While they mend nets, they practice the old songs, but still their brothers do not come. The people go down to the shore, looking out to sea for a sign. Perhaps they have forgotten. Perhaps they wander, lost at sea, uncertain of their welcome with those they left behind. The rains are late, the water low, the forest trails turned dusty and dry and covered in a steady rain of yellow spruce needles. The prairies up on the headland are crisp and brown, without even fog to moisten them. Far out, beyond the pounding surf, beyond the reach of canoes, in the inky darkness that swallows light, they move as one body, a school, turning neither east nor west until they know. So he walks the path at nightfall with a bundle in his hand. Into a nest of cedar bark and twisted grass, he lays the coal and feeds it with his breath. It dances and then subsides. Smoke pools darkly as the grasses melt to black and then erupt into flame, climbing one stem and then another. All around the meadow, others do the same, setting in the grass a crackling ring of fire that quickens and gathers, white smoke curling upward in the fading light, breathing into itself, panting across the slope until its convective gasp sets the night alight, a beacon to bring their brothers home. They are burning the headland. Flames race on the wind until they are stopped by the wet green wall of the forest. 1,400 feet above the surf, it blazes, a tower of fire, yellow, orange, and red, a massive flare. The burning prairie billows smoke, roiling white with undersides of salmon pink in the darkness. They mean for it to say, come, come, flesh of my flesh, my brothers, come back to the river where your lives began. We have made a welcome feast in your honor. Out at sea, beyond where the canoes can go, there is a pinprick of light on a pitch-black coast. A match in the darkness, flickering, beckoning below the white plume that drifts down the coast to mingle with the fog, a spark in the vastness. The time has come. As one body, they turn to the east, toward the shore and the river of home. When they can smell the water of their natal stream, they pause in their journey and rest on the slackening tide. Above them all on the headland, the sparkling tower of fire reflects on the water, kissing the reddened wave tops and glinting off silver scales. By sunrise, the headland is gray and white, as if dusted by an early snow. A cold drift of ash falls on the forest below, and the wind carries the tang of burnt grass. But no one notices, for they are all standing along the river, singing a welcome, a song of praise as the food swims up the river, fin to fin. The nets stay on the shore, the spears still hang in the houses. The hook-jawed leaders are allowed to pass, to guide the others, and to carry the message to their upriver relatives that the people are grateful and full of respect. The fish course by the camp in great throngs, unmolested as they make their way upstream. Only after 4 days of fish have moved safely by is the first salmon taken by the most honored fisher and prepared with ritual care. It is carried to the feast in great ceremony on a cedar plank and a bed of ferns, and then they feast on the sacred foods, salmon, venison, roots, berries, in sequence for their places in the watershed. They celebrate the water that connects them all in a ritual passing of the cup. They dance in long lines, singing thanks for all that is given. The salmon bones are placed back in the river, their heads facing upstream so that their spirits might follow the others. They are destined to die as we are all destined to die, but first they have bound themselves to life in an ancient agreement to pass it on, to pass it on. In so doing, the world itself is renewed. Only then the nets are set out, the weirs are put in place, and the harvest begins. Everyone has a task. An elder counsels the young one with the spear, "Take only what you need, let the rest go, and the fish will last forever." When the drying racks are full with winter food, they simply stop fishing. And so, at the time of dry grasses, the fall Chinook arrived in legendary numbers. The story is told that when salmon first arrived, he was greeted on the shore by Skunk Cabbage, who had been keeping the people from starvation for all those years. "Thank you, brother, for taking care of my people," said Salmon, and he gave Skunk Cabbage gifts, an elk hide blanket and a war club, and then set him in the soft, moist ground so he could rest. The diversity of salmon in the river, Chinook, Chum, Pink, and Coho, ensured that the people would not go hungry, likewise the forests. Swimming many miles inland, they brought a much-needed resource for the trees, nitrogen. The spent carcasses of spawned-out salmon, dragged into the woods by bears and eagles and people, fertilized the trees as well as Skunk Cabbage. Using stable isotope analysis, scientists traced the source of nitrogen in the wood of ancient forests all the way back to the ocean. Salmon fed everyone. When spring returns, the headland becomes a beacon again, shining with the intense green light of new grass. The burnt and blackened soil heats up quickly and urges the shoots upward, fueled by the fertilizing ash, giving the elk and their calves a lush pasture in the midst of dark forests of Sitka spruce. As the season unfolds, the prairie is awash with wildflowers. The healers make the long climb to gather the medicines they need, which grow only here on the mountain they call the place where the wind always blows. The headland juts out from the shore, and the sea curls around its base in white curls. It is a place for the long view. To the north, the rocky coast. To the east, ridge after ancient ridge of moss-draped rainforest. To the west, the unbroken sea. And to the south, the estuary. An enormous sand spit arcs across the mouth of the bay, enclosing it and forcing the river through a narrow path. All the forces that shape the meeting of land and sea are written here, in sand and water. Overhead, eagles, bringers of vision, soar on the thermals that rise off the head. This was sacred ground, reserved for seekers of a vision who would sacrifice by fasting alone for days in this place where the grasses give themselves to fire. They would sacrifice for the salmon, for the people, to hear the Creator's voice, to dream. Only fragments of the story of the head remain with us. The people who know it were lost before their knowledge could be captured, and the death was too thorough to have left many tellers behind. But the prairie kept the story of the ritual fires long after there were people here to speak of it. A tsunami of disease swept the Oregon coast in the 1830s, the germs traveling faster than covered wagons could. Smallpox and measles came to the native peoples, diseases for which they had no more resistance than did grass before a fire. By the time the squatters arrived around 1850, most of the villages were ghost towns. Settlers' diaries record their surprise at finding a densely forested place with a pasture all ready for their livestock, and they eagerly set their cows out to fatten on the native grasses. In the way of all cows, these no doubt followed the paths that already lay on the land, pressing them even more decisively into the soil. Their presence did some of the work of the lost fires by preventing encroachment by forest and fertilizing the grasses. As more people arrived to take the remaining land of the Nechesne, they wanted even more pasture for their Holsteins. Flat land is a hard thing to come by in these parts, so they cast a covetous eye on the salt marshes of the estuary. Situated at the meeting point between ecosystems, with a mix of river, ocean, forest, soil, sand, and sunlight at this edge of all edges, estuaries can have the highest biodiversity and productivity of any wetland. They are a breeding ground for invertebrates of all sorts. The dense sponge of vegetation and sediment is riddled with channels of all sizes, matching the sizes of salmon that are coming and going through its network. The estuary is a nursery for salmon, from tiny fry just days out of the red to fattening smolt adjusting to saltwater. Herons, ducks, eagles, and shellfish could make a living there, but not cows.
that sea of grasses was too wet. So the Westerners built dikes to keep the water out, engineering they called reclaiming land from the sea, turning wetlands into pasture. The diking changed the river from a capillary system to a single straightened flow to hurry the river to the sea. It might have been good for cows, but it was disastrous for young salmon who were now unceremoniously flushed to the sea. The transition to salt water is a major assault on the body chemistry of a salmon born in freshwater. One fish biologist likens it to the rigors of a chemotherapy transfusion. The fish need a gradual transition zone, a halfway house of sorts. The brackish water of estuaries, the wetland buffer between river and ocean, plays a critical role in salmon survival. Drawn by the prospect of fortunes to be made from canneries, salmon fishing exploded. But there was no more honoring of the returning fish, no guarantee of safe passage upstream for the early arrivers. Adding insult to injury, construction of upstream dams created rivers of no return, and degradation by cattle grazing and industrial forestry reduced spawning to nil. The commodity mindset drove fish that had fed the people for thousands of years close to extinction. To preserve the revenue stream, they built salmon hatcheries, turning out industrial fish. They thought they could make salmon without rivers. From the sea, the wild salmon watched for the blaze on the headland and saw nothing for years. But they have a covenant with the people and a promise to Skunk Cabbage to care for them. And so they came, but fewer and fewer every time. The ones that made it through came home to an empty house, dark and lonely. There were no songs or fern-decked tables, no light on the shore to say welcome back. According to the laws of thermodynamics, everything has to go someplace. Where did the relationship of loving respect and mutual caregiving between people and fish go? The path rises abruptly from the river and steps cut into the steep slope. My legs burn as they push up over roots of massive Sitka spruces. Moss, fern, and conifer repeat a pattern of feathery forms, a tessellation of green fronds block printed on the walls of the forest, which draw close. The branches brush my shoulder and compress my view to the path and my feet. Walking this trail turns me inward, under the small dome of my own head, my busy mind clicking away over an interior landscape of lists and remembrances. I hear only the tread of my own feet, the swish of my rain pants, and my heartbeat, until I arrive at a stream crossing where the water sings as it falls over the sheer drop, throwing up a fine mist. It opens my eyes to the forest. A winter wren chatters at me from the sword ferns. An orange-bellied newt crosses my path. The spruce shade eventually gives way to dappled light as the trail ascends to enter a skirt of white-stemmed alder below the summit. I want to walk a little quicker, knowing what is ahead, but the transition is so seductive that I force myself to step slowly and savor the anticipation, taste the change in the air and the lift in the breeze. The very last alder leans away from the thread of the trail as if to set me free. Black against the golden grass and many inches deep into prairie earth, the trail follows the natural contours as if centuries of footfalls have preceded my own. It's just me, the grass, and the sky, and two bald eagles riding the thermals. Cresting the ridge releases me into an explosion of light and space and wind. My head catches fire at the sight. I cannot tell you more of that high and holy place. Words blow away. Even thought dissipates like wisps of cloud sailing up the headland. There is only being. Before I knew the story, before the fire lit my dreams, I would have hiked here like everyone else, snapping photos at scenic viewpoints. I would have admired the great sickle curve of the yellow sandspit enclosing the bay and the lace edge waves riding up the beach. I would crane around the knoll to see how the river cuts a sinuous silver line through the salt marsh far below on its way from the dark line of the coast range. Like the others, I would edge toward the bluff and thrill to the vertiginous drop to the surf pounding the base of the headland 1,000 feet below. Listen to the seals barking in the echo chamber of the cove. Watch the wind ripple the grass like a cougar pelt, and the sky going on, and the sea. Before I knew the story, I would have written some field notes, consulted my field guide about rare plants, and unpacked my lunch. I would not have talked on my cell phone, though, as the guy at the next overlook is doing. Instead, I just stand there, tears running down my cheeks, in nameless emotion that tastes of joy and of grief. Joy for the being of the shimmering world, and grief for what we have lost. The grasses remember the nights they were consumed by fire, lighting the way back with a conflagration of love between species. Who today even knows what that means? I drop to my knees in the grass, and I can hear the sadness as if the land itself was crying for its people. Come home. Come home. There are often other walkers here. I suppose that's what it means when they put down the camera and stand on the headland, straining to hear above the wind with that wistful look, the gaze out to sea, the look like they're trying to remember what it would be like to love the world. It is an odd dichotomy we have set for ourselves between loving people and loving land. We know that loving a person has agency and power. We know it can change everything. Yet we act as if loving the land is an internal affair that has no energy outside the confines of our head and heart. On the high prairie at Cascade Head, another truth is revealed. The active force of love for land is made visible. Here, the ritual burning of the headland cemented the people's connection to salmon, to each other, and to the spirit world, but it also created biodiversity. The ceremonial fires converted forests to fingers of seaside prairie, islands of open habitat in a matrix of fog-dark trees. Burning created the headland meadows that are home to fire-dependent species that occur nowhere else on Earth. Likewise, the first salmon ceremony, in all its beauty, reverberates through all the domes of the world. The feasts of love and gratitude were not just internal emotional expressions, but actually aided the upstream passage of the fish by releasing them from predation for a critical time. Laying salmon bones back in the streams returned nutrients to the system. These are ceremonies of practical reverence. The Burning Beacon is a beautiful poem, but it is a poem written physically and deeply on the land. People love the salmon the way fire loves grass, and the blaze loves the darkness of the sea. Today, we only write it on postcards. Terrific view from Cascade Head, wish you were here. And grocery lists. Pick up salmon, 1.5 pounds. Ceremony focuses attention so that attention becomes intention. If you stand together and profess a thing before your community, it holds you accountable. Ceremonies transcend the boundaries of the individual and resonate beyond the human realm. These acts of reverence are powerfully pragmatic. These are ceremonies that magnify life. In many indigenous communities, the hems of our ceremonial ropes have been unraveled by time and history, but the fabric remains strong. In the dominant society, though, ceremony seems to have withered away. I suppose there are many reasons for that: the frenetic pace of life, dissolution of community, the sense that ceremony is an artifact of organized religion forced upon participants rather than a celebration joyfully chosen. The ceremonies that persist, birthdays, weddings, funerals, focus only on ourselves, marking rites of personal transition. And at least in our little town, we know it's not an empty ritual. The ceremony has power. Our collective good wishes really do fuel the confidence and strength of young people about to leave home. The ceremony reminds them of where they come from and their responsibility to the community that has supported them. We hope it inspires them. And the checks tucked into the graduation cards really do help them make their way in the world. These ceremonies, too, magnify life. We know how to carry out this rite for each other, and we do it well. But imagine standing by the river, flooded with those same feelings as the salmon march into the auditorium of their estuary. Rise in their honor. Thank them for all the ways they have enriched our lives. Sing to honor their hard work and accomplishments against all odds. Tell them that they are our hope for the future. Encourage them to go off into the world to grow, and pray that they will come home. Then the feasting begins. Can we extend our bonds of celebration and support from our own species to the others who need us? Many indigenous traditions still recognize the place of ceremony and often focus their celebrations on other species and events in the cycle of the seasons. In a colonist society, the ceremonies that endure are not about land. They're about family and culture, values that are transportable from the old country. Ceremonies for the land no doubt existed there, but it seems they did not survive immigration in any substantial way. I think there is wisdom in regenerating them here as a means to form bonds with this land. To have agency in the world, ceremonies should be reciprocal co-creations, organic in nature, in which the community creates ceremony and the ceremony creates communities. They should not be cultural appropriations from Native peoples, but generating new ceremony in today's world is hard to do. There are towns I know that hold apple festivals and moose mania, but despite the wonderful food, they tend toward the commercial. Educational events like wildflower weekends and Christmas bird counts are all steps in the right direction, but they lack an active reciprocal relationship with the more than human world. I want to stand by the river in my finest dress. I want to sing strong and hard and stomp my feet with 100 others so that the waters hum with our happiness. I want to dance for the renewal of the world. Thank you.
topic of the week, anarchist speaking tours and other adventures. Reading through some of the Emma Goldman archives, I'm reminded and amazed to see the amount of speaking tours Emma and friends held. At one point in time, over 6 months, she traveled to 50 different cities in 18 different states, delivering over 150 lectures and debates, and that's probably not even the biggest stat for this kind of information about her. During one of her discussions, over 1,800 people attended in a city that nowadays would be lucky to have 20 people attend an anarchist conversation. Over the years, there have been a handful of anarchist speaking tours that have passed through this space, bringing with them excitement and new ideas to consider. While I lack the direct evidence, I feel like these kinds of anarchist events in the world have steadily grown quiet. Would you tend to agree or disagree with that statement, and why is that? Do you have a specific memory of a speaking tour that sticks out in your mind to share? Speaking tour organizers, what tips and advice can you offer for people looking to travel and talk about the most beautiful idea of anarchy? Do we bring back anarchist speaking tours? If so, how? And if not, how come? Blame the internet? Perhaps you'd be interested in taking our anarchist internet poll, which has speaking tours as one possible answer. And there is a link at the bottom of the topic of the week if you are so interested in this poll. Aragorn.
Yes.
You have done quite a bit of speaking and touring.
Yeah, I mean, this is actually one place where, you know, oftentimes we use Crime Think as sort of a whipping post or something. And this is a place where I'm going to say that they've done a totally, a better than okay job. They've done a good job in maintaining and keeping up the speaking tour. I wish that anarchist speaking tours were a thing, but they're not. And to the extent to which they are at all, and we can even have this conversation, it's because of Crime Think's work. It's not because of my work. I mean, I've sort of tried to maintain our project, but this is a place where, like, the fact that I tend to be one person and our collective resources are used so that I, the one person, can sort of go out and tour around. This is a place where Crime Think, they're smarter. And I mean, they have a lot of people.
Sure.
And so they have a group of people, not just one. You know, and it might just be one who writes most of it, but it's more than one person who sort of sits down and says, what does our next speaking tour look like? How do we do it? How do we talk about our pamphlet that, you know, is kind of interesting? And how do we share that? And so so I'm going to talk about them as the model of how a speaking tour could be. The problem with what would be my speaking tours is that I don't want the role of big man talking voice. And so I do a shitty job of most of my presentations. And if you're going to do a good job, you need to be big man talking voice. I mean, Emma Goldman, for whatever else we'd criticize her for, she did a fantastic job of owning what it is that she said, having a thing to say, and then moving on to the next city. And nowadays, you know, it's not appropriate for me to necessarily be the one big man talking voice. And there aren't many people who are good enough to do it.
So the question this brings to my mind, because you're specifically referencing Crime Think and LBC, is that more often than not, like, we want to talk about an idea or a set of particular ideas, usually connected to something that we've published. And mostly, so does Crime Think. And it may, and it may not be a book. It may be a pamphlet. It may be a thing.
But, no, it's true.
Whereas I get, like, I don't think Emma was hawking a book.
Right. That is one of the many differences between that time and now.
So this is about an angry, fired up anarchist woman who wanted to talk to people. And this, and you know, there's probably a whole lot more going on in there, but just my point is being almost as if, like, she were doing it for the sake of itself. And it seems like that really in particular is the thing that we don't do at all.
I'm not sure about that. I mean, first of all, you know, on its face, I would say the idea that people sit in a room and listen to someone talk in the 21st century seems crazy. Like, the fact that it works for anybody is amazing to me. Because by and large, most of our media activities are gravitated towards the individual sitting in front of a screen.
Huh.
And so the idea, come on down.
Yeah.
First of all, the logistics of that are more complicated than they were in the past.
Yeah.
You know, it either has to do with cost or with involving yourself in the university system.
Right.
And then separate from that is just the idea, I do blame the internet, or I blame the fact that society has gravitated towards like, if an individual is going to grapple with an idea, that's a task that's mostly seen as a solitary task, not a social task. And so what you're referring to in the context of Emma, I see as a reflection of the fact that the working class movement for self-emancipation looked different in the late 19th century.
Yeah. Okay. I am tentative because I want a better response to this than blame the internet. It's interesting that you think it works at all when someone talks to a room full of people, when I actually think it is not just not surprising, but almost appropriate that this is kind of one of the last things that still works.
What are your examples?
Well, someone even mentioned it here that, you know,
Jordan Peterson,
you know, that people, that personalities, that someone who is big and they're loud and their ideas are big and loud and they're bigger than the world. And having celebrity helps, but these people fill rooms, whether they're, you know, like Chomsky still fills rooms and sells out.
I mean, I guess these people do that. No denying it, but I'm not sure that anyone a large enough percentage of the room even could tell you an idea that they have before they walk into the room. Like,
sorry, could tell you an idea they have as an individual, or can tell you what one of Chomsky's ideas is?
One of Chomsky's ideas.
Okay.
In other words, this is about celebrity culture. This is about spectacular reality. This is not about
ideas.
Speaking tours being the natural conveyance for ideas. I mean, obviously, I would love it if that were the case, but celebrity is the difference between filling a cafe and filling a university
auditorium.
Yeah,
It's not that I disagree with you. I just don't think I still think that perhaps it's not quite as gloomy as you think it is. And it has been a long time. But I went to when I lived in New York, I went to lots of these things. Mm-hmm. Because it's just New York and these people are just happen to be there, right?
It's the only place outside your apartment where you can actually breathe.
Yeah, this is true. And you feel there's an energy in the room of...
Yes.
No. Hunger? Wanting? People are there for the energy work.
Yes, right, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And some of these people were famous and some of these people weren't so famous. And obviously to even have this discussion, we have to immediately make the scope bigger than the anarchist world, right?
Yes.
You know, who do I get to reach for? Chomsky and Zizek and Peterson and then maybe that it would seem, if we extend out your argument, that's because anarchists aren't celebrities.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah. But, you know, just like, she spoke to 1,800 people.
No, it's amazing.
I can't even conceive.
I mean, for me, I guess I'm just a gloomy sort of person. What's so heartbreaking about that is that speaking to 1,800 people, and they still didn't make a difference. Like, these were people who didn't have the obscurance of Netflix and you porn and whatever in the hell. Like, you know, these people were engaged. They were totally grappling with the ideas. They were with her. And we still lost.
Yeah.
One would feel today, mm-hmm. if they could get 1,800 people into a room, mm-hmm. that...
it was some sort of victory.
That buildings would be leveled afterwards.
Okay, well, now I just don't even know. Aragorn has brought the gloom hammer down, and I am a little bit stymied. So, huh. But I don't... okay. I'm going to recover from this by saying that, yes, they lost, right? The Pinkertons of the state brought the hammer down.
That's not what I'm referring to.
And it all went, well, what are you, I mean, like, people were deported and died and killed and murdered. Like, what do you mean?
That's the way to win an argument without lifting a finger. I'm referring to the fact that, like, the way in which people treat ideas and even debate with each other has totally changed.
You know, sure.
Like our social condition is qualitatively different, and that's not just because of the technologies that we live in now, uh-huh. that we didn't before, mm-hmm. but that's a big factor.
Sure.
And so where do we see critical engagement happen? And I'm like, for many people, the answer is the internet, full stop. But as anarchists, where do we see critical engagement? Because there were more than 1,800 at, you know, the battles of Berkeley. So was that a public voicing of ideas? Have ideas entirely become weaponized and they're not actually something to sort of play around with and have a relationship with? They're only to win or to defend? I mean, for me, these hard questions sort of, I mean, they don't just drill the topic down to anarchist speaking tours. You know, they drill the question down to, like, what does it mean to communicate at all, especially in public? And now to do that in public seems dangerous.
Well, yeah, there's that.
I mean, you know, 3-4 years ago, I thought it was a really good idea to talk about violence in the context of anarchist practice.
Right.
And I now know to not do that.
Right.
But there's tons of conversations that end with, are you a fascist or not? Which, you know, sure. speaks to how stupid the time is that we live in.
So no matter, it definitely does seem like no matter the conversation that you're trying to have, that frequently at the end, people want like a TLDR version of yeah. it, so that it is boiled down to one or two questions right. and very simple answers to those questions. Because I've been in those rooms where I've thought people have given a thoughtful and elegant, lovely talk, and then someone asks a question, and then all the Q&A is about that question, and none of that had anything to do with what they said. And right. it's like right. no one notices yeah. that that's what's happening.
Weren't even listening, yeah. I actually want to end this with a little bit of a talk about LBC.
Okay.
So LBC has tried and failed at this, at some of this, what sure. this topic is about.
Yeah.
Right now we are in a sort of 3-year rebuilding process where when it's over, we intend to travel the world and do anarchist speaking tours.
Right.
So it's like, as much as I'm being critical of this, I in fact think it's something that it's possible for us to do. And that's sort of why we're going to do it. It's because it's possible, not because we think it's going to be successful.
Well, and for me, it's part of the point. The point is to put... So for me, if this were a straight line, it looks like you publish a book, the book goes out into the world, people read the book.
Sure.
Or don't read the book and talk to people who read the book, or, you know, read all the title pages or whatever, and the ideas and the questions and the potential conflicts simmer, and then you get to go and have face-to-face time with those people where you talk about mm-hmm. any and all of those things. And that's the fucking point. If that's not the point, then, like, all of this is in a vacuum and is for naught, as far as I'm fucking concerned.
Most people just cut and paste the answer, the internet.
Ugh.
Yeah.
Ugh, I say. To the internet. Ugh.
Have a great week.
Thanks, you too.
This week's podcast was sound edited by Lynn O'Mabel. The What's New was written by Jackie and Greg and read by Chisel and Greg. The editorial is not an editorial, but a reading of a chapter out of a book by a non-anarchist.
Gasp!
And we thank Aragorn and a friend for their help with the topic of the week. Contact us at podcast@anarchistnews.org to learn more. Anarchist and anti-political books, pamphlets, and other material are available at littleblackheart.com for news by and or about anarchists and up-to-the-minute commentary. See you at anarchistnews.org and or the Anarchist News IRC chat room linked on ANews. Thank you very much. Have a good week.